The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, recently there have been demonstrations as the Cubans continue to deal with harsh American sanctions, and the president of this island nation is pointing the finger at Washington once again for provoking and encouraging unrest in Cuba. Well, stay with us as we put the spotlight on Cuba this edition.
The rally in Havana, with tens of thousands of Cubans taking part. They came together to voice support for the island's government and protest what they see as the U.S. meddling in their country's internal affairs. The rally was held just days after unprecedented unrest erupted in Cuba over an economic crisis aggravated by the coronavirus pandemic. Revolutionary leader Raul Castro and the Cuban president were among those attending the event.
We have come together to once again denounce the U.S. blockade, aggression, and terror. We could not put off this rally. The enemy has once again given everything to destroy the sacred unity and peace of citizens.
The Cuban president criticized the U.S. for spreading false information on social media. He also blasted Washington for defaming his government and inciting hatred and violence. He said the U.S. seeks to undermine peace and stability in Cuba. Criticism of U.S. policies vis-a-vis Cuba has not been limited to its shores. Russia has also accused the U.S. of plotting a color revolution in Cuba.
The logic is simple here. It has been tested on numerous occasions by Washington in various situations, but everything is the same, instigating color revolutions against undesirable regimes. At first, sanctions are introduced against them, and artificial problems are created or imposed from outside, which complicate the social and economic situation. On this basis, tensions are provoked, and anti-government sentiment is stirred up. When a critical mass is reached, the whole blame is laid on the national government. Labels are pinned on it, its activity is discredited, and thus the situation nears a collapse.
Iran, too, says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba and should end its unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The bans were first imposed in 1960 in response to Havana's nationalization of U.S.-owned oil refineries following the Cuban Revolution. The sanctions were later extended. Even racial justice group Black Lives Matter publicly condemned the trade blockade, saying it's at the heart of Cuba's current crisis. In June, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a UN resolution to demand an end to the US economic blockade on Cuba. Only the US and Israel voted against. That was the 29th consecutive year that the UN General Assembly called for the U.S. to end its Cuba embargo. Washington has ignored the international plea every time. U.S. President Joe Biden has called Cuba a failed state. The Cuban leaders deny that. But even if it's true, that claim serves more as an admission of guilt on the part of the U.S. than castigation of the island nation.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight. Out of Leesburg, Dennis Small, Latin American expert. And out of Washington, D.C., Shel Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist. Thank you both for being with me. Let's start this off with Dennis. Your perspective, how do you assess the effect of over 60 years of sanctions by the U.S. on Cuba?
Well, I think these sanctions have been wrong for each and every one of those 60 years. But unfortunately, what we're facing today is a very different context than what has existed until now. And I think that the current sanctions against Cuba and the activities in the Caribbean more broadly are actually very, very dangerous. What I mean is the following. We're facing an international financial breakdown crisis underway in the transatlantic sector. This is something which my magazine, Executive Intelligence Review, has documented in detail. And what you therefore have is among those big financial interests an intent on a radical shift in the direction of world politics as a whole. I think that the blockade and what's happening with Cuba is even worse than it has been described in two regards. First, it is under conditions of a pandemic that was mentioned, I think very importantly so in your lead up to this discussion. Under current conditions, where we have a global pandemic which is out of control, to impose sanctions on countries that are facing this is tantamount to genocide. And I would like to strongly agree with what the Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, has said, which is that all sanctions should be lifted under these conditions. I personally believe all sanctions should be lifted altogether, but certainly under these conditions, since what's happening in various countries with the pandemic, it makes the issues of sanctions and regime change and color revolutions all the worse. Mm-hmm. The second feature of the current development, which I think is really serious, is that it occurs along with similar and related activities in places like Haiti and in South America, and in South Africa as well, not just South America, but South Africa. So I'll leave that for further elaboration.
Okay, well, Cheryl, what about what Dennis said? I mean, he talked about the UN Secretary General Guterres and basically saying, especially under these conditions with the pandemic, that sanctions should be removed. What does that mean exactly? If the UN Secretary General is saying that, if the majority of member states are for that, but then nothing happens, nothing changes. So tell me, what's going on here? What does it all mean?
Well, it all means, as my colleague said, that there is a global initiative on the part of the United States to restructure the world under its domination. Those days are past, but they are not sparing anyone in their striving for hegemony. If you look at, of course, all of the sanctions should be lifted. It's unjust for unilateral economic war to be perpetrated on the people around the world. And Cuba's only one place. It's just the longest one and the one that's closest to the United States. But all of the sanctions should be lifted. I mean, has anybody looked at the fact that without a global response to the pandemic, the coronavirus is not going to go away? And the people who do not have vaccines are basically being thrown to death, and human beings are not expendable. That's a little bit the problem. You see this settler colonial imperialist attitude on the part of the United States saying, well, we're vaccinating people here, but the fact of the matter is, until the whole world is protected against the coronavirus, no one is going to be saved.
Let me cross back over to Dennis. I mean, it's part of a live program, right? Well, Dennis, your take on, you heard what Cheryl was saying. I mean, at the end of the day, what is the U.S. after in continually putting this type of pressure on Cuba? Because she talked about basically that every life is relevant and valuable, but it doesn't seem to be part of the equation in that settler colonialist mentality. How do you see it?
Well, I think you have to distinguish. There's different forces at play inside the United States, as there are in many countries around the world. And I think it's important to understand that there are distinctions and different points of view. Let me explain what I mean. There is an alternative that has been built over the last number of years internationally to the current bankrupt world financial system. And just parenthetically, when I say bankrupt, I mean bankrupt. You have $2 quadrillion in derivatives and financial speculation, which cannot be paid. And the attempt to hold up that bubble is what is behind the war drive. It is what is behind the austerity leading to the pandemic. It is what is behind all of these regime change operations, not just in a country like Cuba or Iran or Venezuela, but attempted regime change in Russia and China. That's what you're getting from the Wall Street and the City of London crowd. But the alternative that is existing at this point and that needs to be backed is what the Chinese have initiated with the Belt and Road Initiative, which many countries have joined in on at this point, in fact, the majority of the world's population, which has a different kind of approach to economics, which is not speculation and looting, but rather infrastructure and economic development. You can see the differences in the way the pandemic has been taken on. Now, we have an immediate situation around Afghanistan, which is, on the one hand, a very gravely dangerous situation, but also offers opportunities for a new kind of approach. Dangerous because with the departure of American troops, which is 20 years overdue after a 20-year war, and which many people in the United States, even included in the military, think that these perennial wars have simply got to stop. But you have a situation where, on the one hand, Afghanistan could easily tilt into becoming a center of world terrorism, of world drugs, of geopolitical destabilization and explosions. On the other hand, you have a confluence of forces coming together around the recent SCO meeting where the neighbors of Afghanistan, even though they have differences among them.
Okay. Well, now it seems to be Dennis's turn.
The forces that can actually help build.
Okay. Dennis, I'm sorry. I think it's your turn right now. We're having a little technical difficulty with you. Let me cross back over to Cheryl now. Cheryl, when we look at it, I mean, even when we're talking about the blockade or the sanctions on Cuba, I mean, isn't the main problem, it's not just the unilateral sanctions by the U.S., it's that the United States will punish or sanction any entity that actually want to have economic relationship with the country. Otherwise, if it was just the United States in itself, there would be so many other alternatives, but that it shuts down everyone and all other countries. Your take.
Yes. The extraterritorial nature of the blockade is really what is insidious. People in the United States, when they saw Barack Obama go to Cuba, it was like, everything is fine now. There's no blockade, relations are quote unquote normal. But the fact of the matter is, even then, the blockade, the economic sanctions, the economic warfare against Cuba continued. And what happens is the laws are so convoluted and complex that it becomes almost impossible to have trade. For example, to have a sale of pharmaceuticals, according to the U.S. law, you have to have a license. Okay, that's fine. To get that license, you have to agree to send a person to Cuba to verify that the end users are the end users. It's not a free and fair trade arrangement where people can, you know, the Cubans can buy from the United States and people and businesses can sell. It's all controlled by the U.S. government, and they make conditions so onerous that it's impossible to do. And then third countries, like, for example, one that's used frequently is that the embassy, the Cuban embassy in Canada, leased Honda vehicles. Should be simple. They go to a Honda dealership in Canada, they lease the vehicle. It turned out that Honda was fined for doing that, because the financial route goes through California, where their leasing office, their big international leasing office is. So even the small thing of leasing a vehicle, of getting deliveries from DHL, now remittances are cut because Western Union can't process remittances to Cuban families. The web is just so hard to negotiate, and it affects the whole world. That's really what's happening, and that's why it needs to end completely. There's the people of the United States are standing up against the blockade. We have resolutions from elected officials and city labor councils all across this country numbering, representing more than 30 million people in the United States. We have people in every state of the union who will stand up and say, hands off Cuba. We are growing the movement here to tell the U.S. government that it is time to end the blockade and that we're not going to be distracted by this, you know, by all of these lies about what's happening in Cuba that are being fomented through a cyber war.
Dennis, you heard what Shell said, but I want to look at one aspect of that because she talked about the growing numbers, the grassroots movement. But in general, is it about the numbers? Because if we're talking about majority, we know that 189 countries actually voted against continued sanctions. So you know, she talked about 30 million people, for example, grassroots movement. Is it about the number of people that can pressure the U.S. government, or is it about the 1% which controls the U.S. government that actually that's where they make the whatever decision they want to make?
I don't think it's either. I think the growth of 30 million people on policies that are appropriate is very good. But I want to emphasize that we're facing a different situation than we've been looking at for decades. There is a world financial breakdown crisis underway. That opens great dangers and great possibilities for a change in the big picture. If we don't change that big picture, the littler pictures, with all due respect to smaller countries, is not going to change. You have on the global strategic scene an alternative which is being put together around the Belt and Road Initiative, and that is an extraordinarily important counterweight, which is an area which people inside the United States should link up with. To bring sufficient pressure on this to change the situation, you're going to have to address the underlying blowout conditions in the world financial system and the economy, which is springing up these crises, creating these crises in various places. Listen, on this Cuba question, the president of Haiti was assassinated 4 or 5 days before the big demonstrations or the little demonstrations in Cuba, the unusual demonstrations in Cuba. Within 2 days of the president of Haiti's assassination, one of the three governments of Haiti that was claiming to be the government called for the United States to send in troops. Now, as of now, the Biden administration has said no, but it's not a very strong no. And I believe this is a very real possibility, given that there are people who are looking for a war with Russia around Ukraine and a war with China around Taiwan. So I think it's very important to look at the big picture. People should recall that Cuba is closer to Haiti than it is to the United States. We have the proverbial 90 miles or 103 miles between Cuba and Florida, but there's 60 miles from Cuba to Haiti. And the part of Cuba which is closest to Haiti is Guantanamo. Now, I'm not saying we're going to have another Bay of Pigs tomorrow, but I am saying there is an intention from a policy layer internationally to create crises everywhere to maintain their global system in place, and it's a financial system. Therefore, I think it's most useful to look at how to affect that global problem, change that, if we hope to have changes in policy such as this not only criminal but really stupid policy, suicidal policy of sanctions against countries like Cuba or Venezuela or Iran and so forth. I mean, after all, we may think that we have a wall built around the rest of the world on the pandemic, but I would recommend that people read Edgar Allan Poe's story on the Mask of the Red Death as to what happens when people think that they can simply wall themselves out of a problem which is international and the pandemic does not respect borders or anything of the sort. It's good we've got vaccines here. The whole world should have them, but the vaccines will not stand up to new variants if we don't guarantee that the entire planet is safe from this problem. So that's what I mean by the global problems.
Shell, your take, because we're just about, we're running out of time. What needs to happen to change the status quo? I mean, we've been looking at this since 1959, since the victory of the Cuban Revolution in that country, the continual pressure by the U.S., the sanctions by the U.S., the military aggression also, and threats. What has to change?
Well, what has to change, what is what we in the United States can do, because fundamentally, even though we laud the support from around the world and the voices from around the world, and it's very necessary, but fundamentally, it's our responsibility. It is a government that is acting in our name. And we have to really find a way, and that's why I emphasize that we've been doing this grassroots work. We have elected officials, we have elected bodies. I couldn't agree more that there are at least three, maybe more international crises that are transforming our world, not in a good way. One is the economic financial crisis, one is the pandemic, and the other is the environment. These crises are not going to be postponed. They're going to cause all sorts of problems and hardships inside our country, okay. Countries generally. Okay. So we have to step up the fight here at home.
And Dennis, 40 seconds. What needs to happen in your perspective?
The United States should join with China, Russia, and other countries in the Belt and Road Initiative. The fact that President Biden did sit down to talk with Putin is very positive, even though nothing particular came out of that except the continuation of talks, recently a four-hour discussion. It is in the self-interest of the United States to work, for example, with China to build up the economic situation throughout the entire Caribbean region. If you have illegal migration, you have to build these areas up economically and make them strong. And I think that this is something which the United States must be brought to understand is in our own self-interest.
Okay. And on that note, hate to interrupt you both, but I appreciate you being with us. We're out of time. Dennis Small, Latin American expert out of Leesburg, and Shel Labash, writer and anti-imperialist activist out of Washington, D.C. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Goodbye.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light, and there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. A warm welcome to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio. This is the movie critique program, and I'm Muhammad Javad, the host of this program, and my dear guest, like always, Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hussein. Brother Hussein, salam alaikum, and welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum salam, glad to be here.
Well, and Sayyid Abdullah, salam alaikum, and welcome to the studio.
Wa alaikum salam, wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, Sayyid Abdullah, last time, near the end of the previous episode, I asked Brother Hussein a very important question, and that was something that was somehow raised within the movie Replicas that we started, in fact, criticizing from the previous episode on. And this movie, as you have seen, Keanu Reeves, the major character in this movie, was thinking very hard because they had a failure with a robot in order to transfer the consciousness into the robot, and then the robot doesn't really come to this realization and asks the question, who am I, right? Mm-hmm. And this who am I is a very important phrase to, let's say, stop and work on now. What is this who am I, and what is this consciousness that we are talking about, and is it similar to the concept of soul.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. What they were trying to do is basically, that's what they're trying to say, is that the soul is consciousness, because if you're not conscious,
mm-hmm.
then you're pretty much dead, right? If
yes.
you're dead, you have no soul.
Mm-hmm.
You only feel and touch and do all these things because you have a conscious, which is, I don't know, some neutrons and protons and God knows what kind of things going in your head
yes.
that activates and that makes you feel who you are. So I think this is what they were trying to get to this, because I think I read this somewhere in psychology before, where they said, like, somewhere in the back of the brain, all these chemical things play a role and create consciousness.
Yes.
Right? So they're saying, okay, let's map that, transfer to someone else, and, you know, that's it. That's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to completely eliminate the idea of soul. So they're saying, when they talk about consciousness, the whole idea, the whole time, is basically they're saying there's no soul. So once you have a consciousness, once you wake up, that's it. You have the information already installed or uploaded according to the movie, then you continue where you stopped at.
Yes.
Your consciousness just kicks in. So they completely eliminate the process of a soul, which I think in another way, like the Brother Hassan said, it's somehow atheistic idea, which
exactly.
they're trying to say, well, God is not the one that gives soul. It's not God, it's conscious. And conscience can be transferred. If it's a matter of the brain working, then the brain is working fine. We're just going to inject it with a bit of information and boom.
This is what I think. Do you think the same thing that, like, this could be, in fact, a kind of atheistic version of what we call soul, what we theists basically call soul? This is something like a kind of theistic substitute for that. Like, we know that, for example, Marxists
mm.
or materialists,
mm.
more specifically, or broadly speaking, on the other hand, when they are talking about that kind of, like, first thing that moved everything, like the idea of mover and moved,
mm.
like the Platonic
yeah.
Concept.
Yeah.
All right. Well, when they are talking about that kind of the first cause or the first thing that moved everything, they
mm.
say that it is material. So
yeah.
this material, the first material, caused everything.
The
all
Big
right?
Bang.
Yeah. You have the Big Bang and the stuff
mm.
like that, and there's no purpose behind it. It's all random and the stuff
yeah.
like that. All
yeah.
right? It goes on and on. But theists, in fact, try to call this first cause as God, and there is no
yeah.
mover behind this God.
Correct.
Right? Do you think that's kind of a substitute like the materialist idea?
I wouldn't say a substitute per se, because this is not even what you called an atheistic replacement or
mm-hmm.
A substitute. Rather, it's a scientific. See, the scientific world, you know, the world of science,
mm-hmm.
When they look at the soul, they look at a superstitious thing.
Yes.
Unless you're a scientist and a Muslim, or a scientist and a Christian,
yes.
like you have a belief, then you will believe in the soul. Because science itself cannot explain the soul. So scientists in general, if something they cannot explain or something that there's no physical evidence to,
mm-hmm.
they don't believe in to
yes.
begin with. So you can
yes.
have scientists who are Christians or other religions, but let's say they're not religious people themselves. Like, what is the soul? Like, that's just superstition.
Yes.
But I, as a scientist, I have to believe in what I have, what I can touch and feel, something
mm-hmm.
tangible, something
yes.
I could work on. So when it comes to consciousness, I can explain consciousness. I can explain how the brain works. I can explain how the body works and how the brain controls everything. Therefore, it's in the head. It's not something that comes from a different world, like Brother Hassan said, it's a vehicle and just, you know, the driver comes in and then once the body dies, the driver goes out.
Yes.
Because they don't have that belief. They don't believe, like, they're not monotheists in their belief, so they don't believe in the soul as well. So generally speaking, the whole scientific world, that's their approach.
Yes.
Be it atheist or non-atheist, their approach is there's no soul, there's just consciousness.
Yes.
So it's, I think it's more abroad than a substitute, just a belief. So you have the religious belief of a soul, and you
yes.
have the belief that just conscious, and we can know what it is, and we all have to do is just slowly progress, and we'll get there.
Okay. Let's take a break and we'll be back continuing this discussion.
Who am I? You're coming online.
Who am I?
Goes wrong.
Something already has.
Back to the program Viewpoint on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guests are still Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Hossein. We are talking about the movie Replicas on the subject of cloning. Well, Brother Hossein, in the first part of our program, or this episode specifically, I asked Sayyid Abdullah about the soul or consciousness, basically, being a kind of substitute for the atheist for the soul that we call the soul, in fact. We believe that we, theists, basically, or monotheists, believe that in addition to the body, we have another realm. This realm is immaterial. You cannot feel it or you cannot touch it. You cannot use the sense data, basically, to understand what it is that you can see, hear, touch, feel, or whatever, right? Sayyid Abdullah gives us this idea. This is not the substitute. Rather, it is a kind of mentality, a kind of worldview that, these people have, and somehow they turn to science in order to answer for or account for lots of questions that we have, man has, basically. All right? Do you think this kind of resort to science, in fact, although it is logical, although it sounds true to be true, actually, all right? But provides this context for some people, in fact, to, let's say, reject or deny the idea and existence of that immaterial, non-corporeal part of human beings.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So I'd like to start off, actually, with a quote from the movie. So early on in the film, there is, there is the doctor, Dr. William Foster, I believe, mm-hmm. played by Keanu Reeves, and his wife. His wife's name is Mona.
Yes.
Right? And she says, maybe there is more that makes us human like a soul.
Mm-hmm.
So this really puts into the question that does the scientist... Dr. William actually believed that there is more to humans than their bodies and their physical attributes, or is there something else, like a person who's controlling this vehicle? So to answer your question, what I think about what these scientists believe in is that we non-atheists, we monotheists, like a Muslim like me, I believe that there is a soul and there is a consciousness and there is a body. The consciousness to me is a part of the body. That's what I think. The soul comes in later and, you know, it kind of activates. The consciousness is more of a feeling mm-hmm. that the body feels when it's powering up. It's like, turning on the car, the engine revs, the lights turn on, they're getting warm. That's what humans feel, and we call it consciousness. And that is, of course, powered by the soul. But in terms of the scientists, they believe that consciousness is, either the soul itself, or it's like I said, it's like part of the waking up process. And behind the consciousness, in place of the soul, is like, a touch from Mother Nature or something, like mm-hmm. science, or some chemical reactions that are happening that make us feel and wake up and realize and
yes.
be conscious.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take another break and we'll be back and continue our discussion on the movie Replica.
Okay. Just because I think I can do it doesn't necessarily mean I can, okay? There is a reason human cloning is banned, and just because it's hard to do is only half the issue here.
Just let me know what we need.
Look, William, I know you've been through hell, but you need to understand something here, okay? The first few animals I cloned came out blind. Their skulls were deformed. Their internal organs, they weren't internal anymore, man. That's what a mistake here means. And if we make a mistake, I need to know if you're prepared to terminate.
Back to the program Viewpoint on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, and my dear guest speakers are Brother Hussein and Sayyid Abdullah. We were talking about the movie Replicas and criticizing this movie on the subject of cloning. Sayyid Abdullah, how do you define soul, this immaterial part of human being, to especially an atheist?
When it comes to identifying the soul, we as Muslims, we don't know. Like, I can't tell you because the Quran says, وَيَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الرُّوحِ قُلَ الرُّوحِ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, says from my God, one of the affairs of Allah. وَمَا أُوتِيتُم مِّنَ الْعِلْمِ إِلَّا قَلِيلًا. What I've been given from knowledge is very little.
Yes.
So if I and my Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he doesn't know much about what the soul is, how can I explain to an atheist? We as Muslims, we have when it comes to our beliefs, there are two things. We believe in the seen and the unseen. Alimul Ghaib, what we call the unseen, we have to believe in that. That's why the Quran says, ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. And then the Quran says, الَّذِينَ يُؤْمِنُونَ بِالْغَيْبِ. Those who believe in the unseen. There's an aspect of Islam that Allah wants from me and you, is that to believe in the unseen. That's it. Don't question it. Believe there's a God. Believe there's angels. Believe there's things. Don't question them. That's part of your belief. Actually, it's a test to begin with. To believe in something that you have not seen, you have not touched. So a soul is one of these things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he spoke about in the Quran, is the, you know, the is the core where the person feels pain and suffering and same time happiness and joy. It's the soul that will be punished in the grave. It's the soul that will be resurrected. It's the soul that will be questioned. The soul that will be either enters heaven or hell. No, but the body will die and will get decomposed in the grave.
Yes.
So it's all the soul. So what is the soul? I don't know. It's part of my belief and I believe in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
An atheist, on the other hand, he says, look, it's just a body dies and that's it. Like I said, call consciousness, call it whatever you like. There's nothing there. So it's very hard to explain something that you don't know what it is. It's more like just a submission. That's why Islam, one of the meaning of Islam is to submit. Yes. Aslama,
yes.
Right? That's it.
Isn't it similar to the idea or the concept of God himself?
Which one?
Like, the definition, because you can't basically define God.
Exactly, so you can't define God.
As you
can't
define the soul.
Exactly, you can't. There are a lot of things in life, not just God, like a lot of, like air. What is air? We don't know what air is, but who knows that? Like frequencies, waves, we don't know, you know, we know they exist. We don't know what they are, right? Like, I mean, not scientifically to give a definition of them, but how they form? We don't know.
Scientists can verify, for example, and analyze the air into oxygen, hydrogen, and the stuff like that, right? But God is something that cannot be divisible, right?
Exactly. So God cannot be visible, cannot be defined, right? So the soul is not visible, cannot be defined. I cannot define it because I don't know what it is. But all we know is, even an atheist would agree to this, that the body, once it dies, it dies. Something leaves it. That's why it's just not operating anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? You want to call it consciousness? Call it consciousness. That's from your belief. From my belief, I call it soul.
I see.
And then we agree to disagree at the end of the day. But how do I define to them? Like I said, if the Quran says you will not know, then I give up.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sayyid Abdullah. And thank you very much, Brother Hussein. This is the end of this episode. We were talking about or criticizing the movie Replicas on the subject of cloning in this program on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, signing off.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Around the World with Reporters.
The cleanup operation continues in Belgium and Germany, the countries worst affected by last week's devastating floods following torrential rainfall. Senior figures from the European Commission have just attended a meeting of EU environment ministers.
50 degrees northwest Canada, 40 degrees in Siberia, 40 degrees in Central Europe, the floods you've mentioned, droughts agriculture is dealing with, wildfires.
Last week, the European Commission unveiled plans to cut greenhouse gas emissions in the 27-nation bloc by 55% over the next 9 years. The Commission claims it's a matter of life and death.
The inferno sent hurricanes we have seen over the last few weeks are only a very small window into what our future could look like.
Environmentalists point to what's happening right now. Raging wildfires in parts of the United States and Canada, severe flooding in regions of China, crippling droughts in areas of Iran, recent tornadoes in the Czech Republic. In order to save the planet, campaigners insist the EU must cooperate with big powers like Russia, China and Iran instead of pushing them away.
Official data shows transport accounts for 29% of pollution in the EU, but one large ship generates as much carbon dioxide per day as 80,000 cars. Of course, the aviation industry is another major player, and so too is agriculture. Experts say the key is to cut our energy consumption and be more efficient.
Therefore, what energy a country uses, what sources, what does it burn? Does it burn coal? Does it burn gas, which about has half the emissions of coal? Or does it do renewables, carbon-free sources? This is tremendously important for climate change.
Environmental groups say the EU needs to move faster and claims the bloc's goals are simply not ambitious enough. They are demanding that leaders agree on decisive action when they meet at a major UN climate change conference scheduled for October in Glasgow, Scotland. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The Iranian documentary film Life Among War Flags, which focuses on Afghanistan and the Taliban, directed by Mohsen Islamzadeh and produced by Press TV, has been unveiled in Tehran in the presence of the filmmakers. The documentary movie Life Among War Flags narrates a different story of conflicts between armed groups in Afghanistan. Moreover, it has made research on the role of the Afghan government in such conflicts.
I have been making documentaries for about 17 years now. The Life Among War Flags depicts the story of people whose region is controlled sometimes by the Taliban, sometimes by Daesh, and sometimes by a central Afghan government and the US forces. I believe they are the main victims of the war in Afghanistan. Making this documentary film was very difficult because we had to risk our lives when we went among Taliban forces. We even took part in several Taliban operations to make this documentary film.
One of the special features about this documentary is that they have shown the inner side of the Taliban, which is very dangerous and difficult. Making such a documentary will definitely raise public awareness about the real nature of such groups, which is of course so risky for the filmmakers.
The production of this documentary took 19 months to complete. The documentary's director says it has unveiled a big secret called Taliban and clearly has responded to questions which have for long been formed in the minds of international audiences regarding the nature of the militant group. The documentary film Life Among War Flags takes a deeper look at the lives of Afghan people who have tolerated years of war and bloodshed under different names and have learned to show flexibility to survive. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki and the EU's executive arm, the European Commission, are on a collision course. The Commission is demanding that Warsaw adheres to a recent EU Court of Justice ruling that Poland's disciplinary procedure for judges violates EU law.
We will ask for financial sanctions if Poland does not remedy the situation by the 16th of August. Let me repeat that we have said many times, EU law has primacy over national law.
The Commission has just published its 2021 EU Rule of Law report. It highlights concerns surrounding justice systems and corruption. The Commission says it's examining allegations that EU member Hungary has used spyware to hack into the phones of those criticizing Viktor Orban's government.
We will use all the possible tools to receive more information on this. So, of course, at the internal level with the different services of the Commission, we are starting, you mentioned, investigations. We are starting to collect information.
Other EU countries criticized in the Rule of Law report include Bulgaria, Croatia, and Slovenia. Recently, Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participated in the annual conference of the MKO terrorist organization, sometimes referred to as the MEK. The terrorist group wants to oust the democratically elected government in Iran. Via Skype, former Portuguese MEP Ana Gomes says that the group is mainly funded by Saudi Arabia and Israel.
MEK pays people to participate in their events. So my question is, how much has Prime Minister Janša been paid by MEK?
Critics say the EU is quick to apply sanctions on foreign nations over alleged rule of law breaches, but is very slow to take action when some of its own 27 member states flout basic standards. The Commission's annual Rule of Law report repeatedly highlights the importance of media freedom. It's ironic because the EU's closest ally, the United States, continues to block .com media outlets operated from Iran, including PressTV.com. However, people can still log on using PressTV.ir. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
There seems to be no end in sight to the tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, the US and some of its Western allies, including the UK, have publicly accused actors affiliated with the Chinese government of hacking Microsoft Exchange, an email platform used by corporations. That has escalated the already tense relations between Washington and Beijing, with the Chinese foreign ministry slamming it as, quote, fabricated allegation.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept.
For years, the U.S. and China have been at loggerheads over issues ranging from trade, Hong Kong and Taiwan, to the South China Sea. Last week, China was infuriated further after the U.S. administration warned American companies and investors about the increasing risk of operating in Hong Kong. Washington claimed that those companies face multiple threats, including the Chinese government's ability to gain access to data foreign firms store there. The South China Sea is yet another bone of contention, with the U.S. routinely sending its warships, citing its right to freedom of navigation. The U.S. has no claim over the strategic waters, but it misses no chance to play with the sentiment of other countries having maritime stake over there. The U.K., a major U.S. ally, is also not far behind. London has now announced it would permanently deploy two warships to Asian waters. That despite China's constant warning to the U.S. and its allies over their military activities in the region. It seems the U.S. and its allies are concerned about China's growing influence around the globe.
that was visible in a recent G7 meeting where the leaders of seven wealthy nations agreed to counter China's economic and security influences. U.S. President Joe Biden even urged European and Japanese leaders to offer hundreds of billions in loans to developing countries in a direct challenge to Belt and Road Initiative, which is China's global infrastructure development strategy. Beijing's relations with Washington reached to the lowest ebb during the administration of President Donald Trump, who waged a tariff war on it. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under Trump's successor Joe Biden, but he has shown no sign of discontinuing on his predecessor's hardline policies toward China. That has helped bring the Asian powerhouse closer to Russia, with both forming an invisible alliance. Biden will probably face a nightmare scenario given deepening ties and strategic cooperation between China and Russia, the countries Washington sees as a threat to its global hegemony.
The village of Vaux-sur-Chèvremont on the outskirts of Liège has been devastated. Seven people lost their lives in last week's floods here. Hundreds have been forced to flee their homes.
When the water comes, I see it in my foot. I say, well, okay, we go home. But the water not in my foot come here, and I don't know what to say.
Meteorologists claim 2 months' rain fell here in just 2 days. It's being described as the worst natural disaster for eastern Belgium and western Germany in living memory. However, how natural is it? Climate change is being blamed. Also, there is criticism surrounding planning. Many towns and villages in Europe were constructed on floodplains. Some residents have been told it could be up to 8 months before their homes will be habitable again.
We lost our fridge. We don't even know where he is. He disappeared in the river. Everything is damaged. We have to do everything again.
There was also severe flooding in Netherlands, France and Luxembourg, but there's no doubt Germany and Belgium were hit hardest. Many thousands of homes that were not destroyed are still without electricity, water and gas supplies. It might take weeks before those are restored. Aside from the tragic loss of life, the floods have caused billions of euro worth of damage. Serious questions surround the effectiveness of the EU's flood warning system. Reviews will now be conducted to find out if all this human suffering could have been avoided.
When we get out of the house was the worst moment, because we have the feeling that we have lost everything and let it there and don't save anything.
The European Commission says it stands ready to provide whatever assistance is required. Throughout Tuesday, flags will be flown at half-mast in Belgium as the country observes a national day of mourning. Jerome Hughes in the village of Vaux-sur-Chèvremont, Belgium.
The morning of Eid al-Adha, Yemenis from all walks of life came together in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to call on the international community to redouble efforts to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade imposed on the country.
We are here for the sixth Eid, demonstrating in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The international body has not fulfilled its duty towards the Yemeni people. More than 6 years have passed and we have been subjected to an absurd war that killed thousands of Yemenis. We demand the international community to lift the siege imposed on the Yemeni people and release the oil ships that have already obtained entry permits by the United Nations.
Protesters blasted the United Nations for remaining silent toward the Saudi suffocating siege on Yemen. They called on the international community to take real measures to stop the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and a blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
England's big relaxation of COVID restrictions, among them social distancing and face masks, is finally here. The government has called the changes an important step, but warned the public to be cautious.
This is a virus that is highly infectious, so we have to be careful. We have to remain vigilant. There is no perfect time to take this step. This is as good a time as any, as Chris Whitty has said.
However, many scientists disagree with the timing of this step into the unknown. More than 1,200 international experts have called it an unethical experiment and a threat to the world. The unlocking of England is happening even as the country's prime minister and chancellor become the latest government officials to go into self-isolation over the weekend. Following contact with new health secretary Sajid Javid, who tested positive for the virus before them. The two were originally reported as exempt from quarantining, as they were joining a daily contact testing pilot, but did a quick U-turn shortly after.
But we can also see that they don't believe in their own narrative. It's very plain that they do not believe that this self-isolation would protect them or anybody else that they might have responsibility for. So the first reaction is to grab for something that gets them out of it.
Arrest the police! Arrest them!
The so-called Freedom Day met a protest outside the country's parliament, with the protesters calling for the prime minister to be arrested.
All this at a time when virus cases in the UK are in another rapid upswing, with one of the top scientific advisors to the government warning that the country is headed into the biggest COVID wave yet. Saeed Pariza, London.
How safe are our mobile phones? This is a question many activists and journalists have been pondering for some time now, and according to an investigation by 17 media organizations, it appears that many of their worst fears have been confirmed.
Their investigation found that human rights activists, journalists, and lawyers across the world were targeted by authoritarian states using hacking software sold by Israeli surveillance company NSO Group. The spyware, referred to as Pegasus, acts as malware, infecting mobile phones, enabling operators to extract crucial information and secretly activate microphones.
So they're not just tracking criminals, but they're also tracking any professionals who are doing the job professionally, but the fear of being exposed by these journalists, and you become an enemy.
Saudi Arabia, Morocco, Hungary, India, Azerbaijan, Mexico, and Rwanda are the states that have been accused of purchasing the controversial software, with allegations that the hacking device was used on the phone of Saudi dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi before he was hacked to pieces inside a Saudi consulate in Istanbul back in 2018. Khashoggi's close friends were also believed to have their phones surveilled soon after his murder.
And in Khashoggi's case, this is clear. What he was doing is to expose the dirty things happening in Saudi Arabia, but obviously the kingdom and also the regime, the establishment, is not happy. And when an establishment is not happy, obviously they have all the resources to keep you quiet or to get rid of you.
If these allegations are proven to be true, it will indicate surveillance on a global level from Budapest to Riyadh that is not only a major world crime, but also an attack on the principle of holding authoritarian states to account. Ahmed Kibala, London.
Bilateral ties between Pakistan and a beleaguered government in Kabul have witnessed another low after Kabul recalled its ambassador and other senior diplomats from Islamabad, citing